Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, in part two of his talk, Guy McPherson explains the science behind global warming and why catastrophe is not too strong a word for the pickle we're in. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we'll hear more of Professor Guy McPherson's lecture on the science behind global warming. He spoke in Winnipeg on February 6, 2014. McPherson's thesis is a shocker. Global warming has spiraled out of control. The Earth is getting warmer faster. Rising temperatures will soon destroy the human habitat, and the human species will be kaput by the year 2050. And most other species too. Not a pretty picture, to say the least. In his talk, McPherson surveys the scientific literature and explains in layperson's terms what exactly it is saying. The key concept here is self-reinforcing positive feedback loops. In a nutshell, this means a warmer environment creates chemical and physical changes in the Earth, and each change itself makes it get warmer still. Last week he described one major feedback loop. That one involved methane release from the Arctic seabed. This week, McPherson will discuss three others. We'll have to settle for these four examples, but according to McPherson, the scientific literature has identified 28 feedback loops now in operation. All of them are irreversible. Plus, there are two more that might be reversible. As Stan Laurel would say to Oliver Hardy, this is a fine mess. Let's pick up the speech where we paused it last week. McPherson has just finished describing the sea-based methane feedback loop. Now he'll tell us about some others. Here is Professor Guy McPherson.
Second feedback comes along nearly a year later, again reported in Science. Atlantic water is shooting up through the Fram Strait instead of turning south off the south and east coast of Greenland, as it has typically done. Instead of turning south there as part of the thermohaline conveyor belt, it's actually shooting up through the Fram Strait directly into the Arctic. So as a consequence, since 2011, Arctic temperatures have been much, much higher than historical averages, because we have warm Atlantic water shooting straight up into the Arctic. That's a self-reinforcing feedback loop, because as that water shoots up there, it melts the ice, which exposes more open water, reduces the albedo or the reflectance from the ice. Instead, we have blue open water that absorbs the solar radiation. And so that just goes down and down and down like a spiral. So one self-reinforcing feedback loop in 2010, two through early 2011, Siberian methane is a classic example. Methane isn't just coming out of the Arctic Ocean, it's coming out of the land too. Permafrost. As permafrost melts, it produces methane. The methane is leaking out of the ground as well. It's not the permafrost anymore, it's the permamelt from here on out. In 2010, you can see this stuff on YouTube. You can see scientists going out to Siberia in the summertime and finding these vents, methane vents, that are about 30 centimeters in diameter. And so they go and they light them on the fire when the camera is watching. And it looks like a Roman candle, you know, this big whoosh as they light these methane vents on fire. Apparently just to demonstrate that, hey, Mom, I can make a fire. And look what we're doing to the Earth's climate system. That's summer 2010, methane vents 30 centimeters across. Summer 2011, those methane vents are a kilometer across. Nobody's lighting that on fire. That'll take your eyebrows off. When we talk about rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear response, that's what we're talking about. Nine orders of magnitude increase in size in a single year, a million times bigger from one year to the next in terms of the methane vents. Third feedback reported is drought in the Amazon. This is pretty interesting, because drought in the Amazon, the Amazon, that's really the lungs of the planet. That's the respiratory system. The Amazon is supposed to be sequestering a bunch of carbon, and instead, during 2010, reported in 2011, it emitted a bunch of carbon. It became a net source of carbon instead of a sink for carbon. But dig a little deeper, we have drought-induced mortality of trees contributing to increased decomposition of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and decreased sequestration of atmospheric carbon dioxide. And that's reported as early as November 2000. So it made a big splash in 2011, and there have been subsequent review articles in Nature and Frontiers in Plant Science. But it's probably something we've known about since 2000, roughly. As the trees die or their growth rate slows, of course they're taking up less carbon than they were before, and of course they're decomposing more rapidly and kicking more carbon up into the atmosphere. Nonetheless, I'm keeping this in as the third of four self-reinforcing feedback loops in 2011. So we have one in 2010, reported in 2010, four reported in 2011, six reported in 2012, and I'm not going to go through all these in much depth because they're just awful. It's just one thing after another, as they say. So we have all kinds of events occurring to the living planet that are influencing atmospheric levels of greenhouse gases, from methane to carbon dioxide and so on. And so we have six of those reported in 2012. So we have one in 2010, four in 2011, six in 2012, and wait for it, 16 in 2013. 16. We're seeing geological events play out in real time. It just keeps going and going and going, and every time I look around, there's another self-reinforcing feedback loop that has been triggered. 16 in 2013. Even in Antarctica, the permafrost is melting. Antarctica. It's a tremendous body of ice, and it's experiencing permafrost melt. So 16 in 2013, and one so far in 2014. So by my count, we had one in 2010, one reported in 2010, four reported in 2011, six reported in 2012, 16 reported in 2013, one reported in so far this year, so that's 28 self-reinforcing feedback loops have been triggered on the climate front. And there's a couple that are reversible as well. Arctic drilling was fast-tracked by the Obama administration in August 2012. Fortunately, as soon as the drilling rigs got up there in 2012, they were battered by the Arctic Ocean. Sometimes nature bats last. And so it'll be at least until this year before the rigs are ready to go back up there and start drilling in places we can suddenly drill that previously were covered with ice. And finally, we have the vaunted Northwest Passage, opened up in the summertime. The ice has turned to slush, so why not save a few bucks by shipping across that? I pointed out that Arctic methane bubbling of the Arctic Ocean, was the first reported in the scientific literature and therefore the best studied. It's also the most feared of the self-reinforcing feedback loops, because people have been writing about the clathrate gun for a long time. James Hansen wrote about it deeply in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. Malcolm Light, writing for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group on February 9th, 2012, predicted extinction by mid-century based on primarily on these half a dozen data points, which appeared to indicate that methane release from the Arctic had gone exponential in 2011. NASA and NOAA subsequently revised that data set and removed all of those points from the data set. And so it looked like maybe Malcolm Light was jumping the gun by predicting extinction by mid-century. But since that time, we've had methane plumes up to 150 kilometers across reported by NASA, as I indicated earlier. Again, this is a huge amount of methane, and methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And so based on the evidence that has accrued subsequently, published in places including Nature, and among the most renowned scientific journals, it looks like Malcolm Light might have been jumping the gun a little bit, but not a lot. And in fact, what he wrote on the 9th of February, 2012 was that methane release will accelerate exponentially, release huge quantities of methane into the atmosphere and lead to the demise of all life on Earth before the middle of this century. So he's not talking about just human life. He's talking about all life on Earth. And I think that's an overstatement, by the way. I don't think we'll be able to get rid of methane-eating bacteria and extremophiles in the deep oceans by mid-century. That's clearly the goal of industrial civilization, is to kill everything. But I don't think we're going to succeed quite that rapidly. Light predicts, based on his analysis, extinction of all life in the northern hemisphere by 2031, plus or minus 13 years. And by 2047 on Earth, plus or minus a similar amount of time. Again, another example of rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. And we're talking about loss of life on Earth. That's extensive ecosystem damage. Again, writing for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, Sam Carana points out a forecast of temperature anomalies, differences from average of greater than 20 C by 2050. That's late last year. All of this indicates to me that there will be little, if any, habitat for humans by mid-century and possibly much sooner, because all the focus has been on one of these self-reinforcing feedback loops. They're multiplicative. They're not additive. They feed off each other. So the faster things go, the faster things go. So it would not surprise me if we see loss of habitat for humans well before mid-century on all of the planet. So what to do? Now what? Well, the political response, interestingly enough, remains the same no matter how much data accumulate. My president, harms me to say those words. If the message is somehow we're going to ignore jobs and growth simply to address climate change, I won't go for that. Greed is our only god. Capitalism is king. Any other way of living is beyond the pale. Civilization, like an airplane in flight, must remain aloft. Or to remain aloft, must remain moving forward. I'm badly paraphrasing Edward Abbey there, who indicates that we just can't slow things down. We can't just slow the plane. You slow the plane to a critical level and it crashes. You slow civilization to a critical level, it just crashes. So there's no politician on the planet who would propose that. Jobs, they're way important. Barack Obama and his cabinet surely knew at the Copenhagen meetings what was reported at the Copenhagen meetings and was actually reported in advance. The long-term sea level that corresponds to current carbon dioxide concentrations right now and then in 2009 was about 385 parts per million. The long-term sea level corresponding to that level of carbon dioxide concentration is about 23 meters above today's level. And temperatures will be 6 degrees C or more higher based on real long-term climate records, not models. So if we look in the deep past and correlate carbon dioxide concentrations with temperature and sea level rise, we see the lag that we're experiencing now. So there's a lag. Carbon dioxide rises, then temperature rises profoundly. And we aren't slowing things down. Not so far, anyway. Speaking of lag, there's a 40-year lag, between causes and consequences when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. From the carbon dioxide we emit today in our coal-fired power plants and our oil-powered automobiles will produce temperature changes in the atmosphere 40 years from now. So when I was 14 and just learning how to drive, that's the consequences we're seeing today. 0.85 C above baseline, 40 years later. For me, this means a couple of things. One, it's horrible. The horror is amazing. We're locked into consequences resulting from the last 40 years. During the last 29 years, we burned more carbon as a result of fossil fuels than in the previous 300 years combined. So we're only getting started in terms of temperature rise and loss of habitat for humans. That's the horrible part. The sort of good news is that I don't really feel guilty about driving a car when I was 14. I don't know about you, but I thought it was about the coolest thing ever. And, of course, I had no clue. At the time, very few people had any idea what the consequences would be in terms of temperature. So I'm suggesting to you a guilt-free experience. This is your get-out-of-guilt-free card. What we did 40 years ago is impacting the planet today. Nobody knew. Nobody told me. I don't know about you. I didn't have that kind of parenting or influence. So what about the individual response? The political response will remain the same. We're going to keep this sucker going until it kills everybody. We drive to extinction some 200 species a day. I don't see anybody suggesting we stop that. So it's pedal to the metal till we hit the wall. That's the political response. That's the social response. The individual response to this information, well, here I quote that classic longtime moral philosopher, the boss, in the end, which don't surrender, well, the world just strips away. Maybe we should let go. Or, from Zen, let go or be dragged. From popular culture, carpe diem, seize the day. When I speak on college campuses, students sometimes point out that I've got the pronunciation wrong. It's crappy diem, as in you just ruined my day. Whatever. Or to quote Nietzsche, live as though the day were here. And one more from the Jewish poet in the Warsaw ghetto, Leon Staff. Even more than bread, we now need poetry in a time when it seems that it is not needed at all. So from an individual perspective, I don't think you can hold yourself responsible for the temperature changes we're seeing today that were produced by our actions 40 years ago. Some people in this audience were not even alive 40 years ago. But you'll be suffering the consequences, and we all will. But I don't think we need to carry that burden with us. I think instead, we need to write poetry and read poetry. I'm like a Hollywood movie. Well, I'm not nearly as good looking as a Hollywood movie. Maybe I shouldn't even use that line. Seems a little filled with hubris, maybe. I'm like a Hollywood movie. In that, I have a happy ending. How's that? It's the most awesome ending of all. DNA ensures our unique status. If I believed in miracles, I'd think every one of us were one. We have enough understanding of DNA to know that the odds against any one of us being here exceed the odds against plucking a single atom from the entire universe. There's that analogy again. There's 10 to the 80th, or 10, somewhere between 10 to the 80th and 10 to the 100th atoms in the entire universe. The odds against this collection of DNA being in this physical form far exceeds that probability. And yet, here we are. We're amazing. We get to die. And that makes us the lucky ones because we get to live. That doesn't happen to almost any collection of DNA. But it happened to us. Seize the day. In the words of evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, in the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I that are privileged to be here, privileged with eyes to see where we are and brains to wonder why. We're truly incredible. Let's ponder that. Let's appreciate that. Let's appreciate each other and the amazing miracle that we are.
A while ago, there was a program, Pandora's Promise, on CNN, and Hansen and some others said the only conceivable way out of our mess is through a shift, a massive shift to nuclear energy. Have you any comment on that?
Oh, right. So a massive shift to nuclear energy, which James Hansen has been promoting for a long time. Right after that program came out, there's a great research study published in the journal literature indicating that nuclear power plants don't save carbon, they produce carbon. I've known for 20 years that they were not carbon neutral because they require so much concrete for the cooling towers. And concrete, producing concrete is enormously expensive in terms of carbon dioxide emissions. But it turns out that building a nuclear power plant and taking it through its life cycle actually is a tremendous producer of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Hansen's wrong. Furthermore, I don't think you have to look very far past Fukushima to figure out that maybe nuclear isn't the right strategy. You know, we're in an era of economic contraction right now, and it used to be we could handle things like nuclear power plants getting a little sketchy. And now we can't handle nuclear power plants getting a little sketchy anymore. And so Fort Calhoun along the Missouri River in Nebraska, I can't even remember the name of the one that showed up in the news yesterday, another nuclear power plant that caught fire in New Mexico, or nuclear processing material. I'm not even sure what it was. So we have all these events going on involving nuclear. You know, that stuff's detrimental to human health for a few million years. Humans have yet to create a structure, a single structure, the last 50,000 years. What hubris to think that we can build nuclear power plants to feed our addiction to electricity forever with no consequences. That seems a little silly to me.
Hi. So I was just wondering, with the advent of renewable resources, how would you change the mindset of a contemporary civilization to kind of switch over and kind of go to a clean energy movement? Is that a possibility? Can we get to that point to reverse some of the runaway climate change? I'm not sure.
Had we started down the quote renewable energy path 40 or 50 years ago, we might have made some progress in that direction, but it's far too late now. And I put renewable in quotes because renewable energy sources are really derivatives. They're derivatives of fossil fuels. It takes a lot of oil to make a solar panel. It takes a lot of coal and oil to make a wind turbine. So these are derivatives of fossil fuels. In addition, maintaining the electrical grid requires liquid fuels. Right? Every time it snows, the wind blows, or we have some event, the lines go down, somebody has to go out there and string the lines back up again. So these are derivatives of fossil fuels. I've written about this at Nature Bats Last and other places. The vaunted third industrial revolution, as it's sometimes called, is not going to happen because it's too late. We're in the realm right now of very expensive oil, and it takes a lot of oil and a lot of coal to make solar panels and wind turbines and wave turbines and all those other things. We're out of rivers to dam. And there's 7.1 billion people who want everything we have. The race is on. We all lose. And I would argue that we really don't need grid-tied electricity anyway. And, you know, we think we're addicted, that we need to have lights come on every time we flip a switch. But really? I mean, we lived 2 million years as human beings and didn't have electricity. It was in the 1960s before the rural South in the United States had grid-tied electricity. 1960s. You know, that's within the lifetime of a significant proportion of the audience here. And nobody died. Nobody died because they didn't have grid-tied electricity. Now we have 7 billion people on an overshot, overpopulated planet. And so it's problematic every time the power goes out.
Hi. Thanks for your presentation. One of the things I'm really curious about is what is the 1% doing? These are the smartest people in the room, and they have the wealth of half a planet to play with and to realize pretty much anything they want to fantasize. So, do they have an island someplace? Do they have a spaceship they're building to go to Mars? Mm-hmm. What are they doing? Or are they really so lost in their delusion that money will save them somehow that they're just going to keep on keeping on?
I think it's all of the above. I think there's a lot of delusion out there. There's probably quite a bit in here. Oh, social filter again. I've been in contact with people who are among the 1%, and a couple of examples come to mind. One of them says, it's too late. Al Gore had access to an audience, and he had access to an unlimited amount of money, and he didn't move the needle one bit. So why should I do anything? the guy won the Nobel Peace Prize, and he didn't move the needle at all. And then another person who is exceptionally wealthy contacted me and said, I want to come visit the mud hut. That's what I call my homestead, the mud hut. And because I'm looking for examples, I want to emulate that when I move to the Southern Hemisphere. You know, James Cameron just bought a whole bunch of New Zealand. He's a pretty wealthy guy. Some people are making plans, I've no doubt, to extend their lives as long as they can. But, I mean, there's a couple of things going on. One, you don't know that you triggered a self-reinforcing feedback loop until after it's in the rearview mirror. Right? So we didn't know about any self-reinforcing feedback loops, according to the Referee Journal literature, until March 2010. So we didn't know we triggered this. So when Tim Garrett wrote his paper for climatic change, published in November 2009, when he said only collapse prevents runaway climate change, he didn't know at that point that we triggered self-reinforcing feedback loops. Also, there's this 40-year lag that's problematic, to say the least. So, you know, not being in constant contact with the 1%, or being one of them, I can't really tell you what they're thinking about, but I bet a lot of them are thinking about the lines of that cartoon, that there's still a lot of money to be made. That's what drives a lot of those people.
Guy McPherson is Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. As I speak these words, the temperature at the University of Arizona is 92 degrees, at 10 a.m. their time, and a high of 103 is predicted. Okay, cheap shot, and I apologize. One day's weather does not prove global warming, or disprove it either. But the science behind it seems pretty strong, and Professor McPherson does a nice job of putting it into layman's terms. The fossil fuel industry's propaganda machine is still at full steam, trying to manufacture doubts that global warming exists, or, if it exists, that it is harmful. But their fellow scoundrels, the insurance industry and the military-industrial complex, they're convinced that global warming is real and also a big problem. They are preparing to address this problem in their characteristic ways. Violence for the Pentagon, skyrocketing insurance rates for the insurance biz. Just this morning, I found a notice from my own insurance company advising that if I want flood insurance for my house, kindly look elsewhere. Allstate Insurance Company does not believe that selling flood insurance in Connecticut makes good business sense. Not a word about the polar ice caps, or the former polar ice caps, but I suspect they figure in here somewhere. From high above the Connecticut River, well, maybe 200 feet above the Connecticut River, let's hope that's high enough. This is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illigitimai non carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.